Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody out to this session. We are in session 221, so if you need to be somewhere else, I thought I'd forewarn you, you might, but if that doesn't surprise you, then you're in the right place. I need to ask that everyone turn off his or her cell phone, pager, tambourine, or any other kind of noisemaker. Today we'll hear from Brian Evanson. Brian is a PhD and chairman of a program in literary arts at Brown University. He is the author of several books of fiction, including Altman's Tongue and Father of Lies. I do want to announce that Benchmark Books is selling copies of Altman's Tongue, Father of Lies, and The Wavering Knife. So those are in the Harvest Room if you'd like to pick up copies of that. We'll turn the time over to Brian. Oh, I do want to mention Brian's going to speak, and then we'll open it up to question and answers. And I'm sure you've heard this litany before, but I'm obligated. Please come with your questions to the open mic here, and because we need to get those recorded. Thank you.
It's very nice to be here in Utah again. I come here periodically, but it's been a few years since I've been to a Sunstone. Probably, now that I start to think about it, may actually almost be a decade since I was last here. The talk I'm going to give today is called Faithful to Whom, Art or the Church, The Dilemma for Mormon Artists and Whether There's a Way Out. And I'm going to mainly be talking about my own situation and but hopefully posing some questions that we can use for discussion as we get to the end of my discourse. I should begin with a disclosure, and the disclosure is that in the year 2000, after several years of increasing inactivity and constant, albeit fairly minor pressure about my writing for Mormon church leaders, I wrote to my bishop asking to have my name removed from the records. After about a year of repeated interviews and the church dragging their feet, in 2001 my request was finally granted. The process that led up to that is all spoken about in some detail in an afterword that I wrote for the paperback edition of Altman's Tongue, which I think, as was mentioned, is being sold here. And I'll speak a little more about it in the words that follow. The reason I chose to have my name removed from the records was not because of a profound disagreement with the doctrines of the church or because of moral differences, but because I felt that I, as a writer, and for the sake of my writing, needed not only the slight separation that I could gain by simply being an inactive member, but the irrevocable separation that excommunication would bring. I don't think that this is the right choice for everybody, but I remain convinced that it was the right decision for me and for my writing. And I remain convinced of this despite the fact that my leaving the church figured very strongly into the collapse of my marriage and the pain and difficulty that that brought about. So, the disclosure is that you will be listening to someone who was, for all intents and purposes, excommunicated by his own choice and still feels very positively about that choice. And as such, I'm someone who believes in making hard choices, and for that reason, am likely to say a few things that some of you might struggle with. I don't want this to be the inverse, though, of the Pillars of My Faith sessions that Sunstone does. I don't want this to be Pillars of My Faithlessness. But instead, I want to try to think out loud as honestly and openly and as possible about the different stages and steps I've gone through in that process. Most of you will hopefully never be in a position where you have to make such a difficult choice, but I can see a few people here who I know have been in that position, and I can see a few other people who have been doing their best to avoid making that decision. And I think it's generally important for writers and artists and people of all walks of life who are living in a restrictive culture to think carefully about what they do and why they do what they do, so that when confronted with pressure, they will know what really matters to them. For those of you who don't know me, let me start with just a few introductory comments. I'm best known in Utah as the author of Altman's Tongue, a book of short stories, which paradoxically enough is probably my least Mormon book, that was first published almost exactly 12 years ago now. It was published, I think, yesterday, 12 years ago. And that was the cause of a certain amount of controversy. In the larger world, I'm known for that book, but also for six others, and I'm probably best known for an anthologized story, Two Brothers, that was originally published in a book called Contagion. As the introducer mentioned, I'm the chair of the Literary Arts Program at Brown University, where I also teach fiction writing and critical theory. When Altman's Tongue was published by Alfred A. Knopf in 1994, I had just started teaching at Brigham Young University. The stories gathered in Altman's Tongue had largely been written while I was a graduate student studying critical theory and English literature at University of Washington. During that same period, I was also a member of a bishopric, first as a second counselor and then as a first counselor. At the time that I was writing the stories, I didn't see any contradiction between what I was writing and the work I was doing as a member of the church and as a member of the bishopric. In fact, because of computer problems with the very old PC that I had as a graduate student, most of the stories in Altman's Tongue were typed late at night in the ward clerk's office in a church building that also doubled as the Institute for University of Washington and as a seminary. I never felt this to be a contradiction either, never felt uncomfortable doing this. This may seem odd considering the controversy the book later received, but I think that this is common for many of us as artists who believe in what we're doing and who have figured out a way to integrate it with our larger life. It's hard not to be surprised when a unity that seems obvious to you seems schizophrenic to a general authority or to a Brigham Young University provost. Indeed, most people found it difficult to believe when my book became the center of controversy that I hadn't seen it coming. I'll try to explain why this was the case for me, or at least give one strand of what it went into my sense of self-integration. One of my duties was to work with transients and decide who to buy groceries for with church funds when I was a bishopric member, who to find temporary housing for. I speak of this in some detail in the afterword for Altman's Tongue. When I was doing that, I became exposed to people that I might not have been exposed to otherwise and listened to their stories. As I began to get to know them better, I began to feel that they were not that different from myself or from anyone else whose acquaintance I might have deliberately sought out. I became very interested not only in how they got to the point they were at, but in why I myself had not ended up there. And answers that at first seemed obvious seemed, with more time, less and less obvious. That led me to a kind of larger and more open-eyed interest in why humans do what they do, and an interest in particular in how humans react in extreme situations. Indeed, I think the shape of Altman's Tongue sprang out of that notion, how do humans react in difficult situations. I've always been a strong believer in the notion that everything in heaven, everything in hell, and everything in between is worthy of our attention, and that, if taken in the right spirit, an honest observation of all things can only make us grow. Having grown up in Happy Valley, having been encouraged to write only positive things in my journal, which I think that practice is personally, I believe, an easy way to sabotage the actuality of one's life, and having as well an interest in contemporary French and American literature, I was more interested in the dark side of existence, partly because I didn't know it nearly as well. I grew up in a place where you could feel transgressive if you drank a caffeinated Coke, or if you rolled your sacred garments a few turns up so that they wouldn't show below your shorts. I also grew up in a place where people had the same struggles and problems as anywhere else, but where many people were interested in keeping these problems hidden or hushed up. Had I grown up in a different way or in a different place, I probably would have felt differently, but what I wanted was a sense of balance, of light and dark. What I wanted was to understand the side of existence that my local culture had always denied was there. I was interested in trying to understand, among other things, violence, partly because when I was growing up, my peers thought it perfectly all right to go to a violent movie, but not all right to go to a movie in which someone was briefly nude. There was something I felt quite odd and deliberately perverse about this, and I wanted to figure out what it was. I wanted to understand why people thought violence in a movie was palatable and figure out why it would make them, what would make them think about it in a different way. I wanted to write a book that made people think seriously about something that they habitually swallowed without thinking about, despite their own sense of themselves as moral creatures. And I wanted to do that partly because I felt that it was easy for me to be complacent about the same issues. When Albenstein first appeared, I'd been teaching for about 8 months at Brigham Young University. After I'd been asked to read from the book and talk about it at a fellow colleague's class, a student in that class, whose identity I never learned, sent a letter to a Mormon general authority. The letter accused me of promoting incest, cannibalism, of corrupting the youth, of writing the sort of book that was precisely the opposite of what a Mormon should write. I know about this letter because that general authority, after cutting off the writer's name, passed it along to the university, and eventually it filtered its way down through the administration and to me. My department chair asked me to write a response to the anonymous letter. Being a new faculty member, I felt like I had no choice, so spent several days writing a response in which I tried to explain why I had written what I had written, and why I was willing to stand behind it. I was told my response would make its way up the chain of command and be seen by all the people who had seen the letter on its way down. But after sitting on my response for 6 weeks, the chair passed it up the line, including with it a memo from himself, which he shared with me, in which he claimed spoke out strongly against anonymous letters, declaring they would not be tolerated. The memo also included this sentence. I've made one change, inserting Brian here for he. Quote, "The bottom line is that Brian knows that this book is unacceptable, coming from a BYU faculty member, and that further publications like it will bring repercussions." Unquote. What does this sentence mean? I asked my chair. I did not believe that Altman's was unacceptable. On the contrary, my very long letter that was appended to this very memo explained why I stood behind the book. My chair, I suspected, had been assigned the task of convincing me that the book was inappropriate and that I needed to stop writing such books. Furthermore, his memo suggested he seemed to think he had done so. I told him again I stood behind my book and that I had tried to make it amply clear that that was the case in my multi-page response to the anonymous letter. I had seen my response as an explanation and at the time still had the faith that if I could just explain to them why I wrote what I wrote, that would be enough. Was what he said true, I asked? Would further publication bring repercussions? My understanding had been that I would be protected by the university's policies on academic freedom, and that I was writing something that fell within the purview of these protections. Was this not the case? Thinking about it now, many years later, I think that there are two things I should have realized at the time. The first is that beliefs are something that can be shared, but not things that can be explained. If they could be, they wouldn't be beliefs. However, I had managed to develop my thinking so that in Seattle, I felt no contradiction between my writing and my system of belief. But nobody who was not already predisposed to agree with me would accept this synthesis as valid. They would see me instead as either deluded or misled. Second, a religion, particularly a religion as corporate as Mormonism is, can never be reasoned with. This is partly due to the fact that religion has belief at its core, partly due to the fact that large organizations, even though they are composed of individuals, have a kind of personality and identity all their own. With a religion that believes its authorities receive direct revelation from God about how the church should be managed, this is especially true. We've all heard both actual and apocryphal stories about moments when certain general authorities personally disagree with decisions being made by the quorum as a whole, but ultimately they seem willing to bow to their elders. The decision always comes out unanimous because the voice uttering the decision is one voice, the voice of the organization. What is to be learned from these two things? Simply this: if you decide to stand up for your own beliefs in the face of your religion, you will lose. Moreover, you need to go in prepared to lose. If they change their minds about you, it is because they are already inclined to change their minds about you. You might lose in a very small way and receive only an indulgent and knowing smile. You might lose in a slightly larger way. For instance, your bishop might say to you, well, I personally agree with you, but I don't think other members are quite ready for this yet, so wouldn't it be better to be a little less vocal about this? It's hard in a statement like this to know where you're at when your actual bishop is speaking and when the institution he is representing speaks through him. It's schizophrenic discourse. What is clear, though, is that the ultimate message is not, I like you and agree with you, but that you need to be less vocal. You might lose in an even larger way. For instance, your bishop might say to you, I personally don't think you're doing anything wrong, but I've been given pressure to hold a church court for you if you don't stop. I just feel you should know. Or in an even larger way, what you are doing is wrong, and if you can't see that, you don't belong in this church. These losses undo us in different ways and with different degrees of seriousness, but they always threaten to undo us, and unless you go in prepared to lose, they will undo you. But the other thing I want to say is that it's worth losing. Being challenged over your art or being challenged over your beliefs, even if it creates a rift between you and your church, makes you think very seriously about what you're doing. It refines you and purifies you and makes your beliefs more textured and ultimately stronger. What I've been saying is true not only of religions, but of religious institutions, religious universities in particular. Particularly universities like Brigham Young, who see their commitment to the religion as more important than their commitment to the academy. For me, this was the case. My request for the university to be frank with me led to several months of administrative hemming and hawing, various utterances with vaguely apocalyptic and threatening subtexts. I was supposed to get the hint, but I've always been stubborn. I wanted them to say it to me directly. And I believed strongly enough in what I was doing with my writing that I was beginning to feel that I might not be willing to give it up, even if it meant losing my job or my membership in the church. I had not been prepared in advance for this situation. Probably if they'd been direct with me immediately, I would have allowed my fear to get the best of me and would have given in greater or lesser ways to what they asked. But the administrative stalling allowed me to prepare myself, to consider what I was doing, and to realize it mattered. Indeed, ultimately, I feel that the Mormon Church did me a favor by putting this pressure on me. It made me think very carefully about every word I was writing and made me committed to every word. It tightened my sense of style. I knew I could be made to suffer for what I wrote, and that made it feel like I needed to be very careful about what I did write. Then the story was leaked to the press, and things suddenly started to happen very fast. There was television and newspaper coverage, strange anonymous threats by phone and by mail, public and private writing by faculty and students both for and against the book, a brown bag discussion of the book by the German department, who were much more supportive ultimately than the English department, and so on. The book was widely reviewed, often appraised, and became a regional bestseller. In the meantime, I felt like I was wandering a bureaucratic maze. As I met with one administrator after another, it became clear that my response to the anonymous letter did not matter to them. I was expected neither to think nor to defend my project, but rather to fall in line, stop publishing what I was publishing, be a good boy. My local church leaders, who were all sympathetic people, declared themselves concerned and asked for help in understanding my fiction. Finally, at a meeting with the president and the provost, I was told that BYU's academic freedom policy was intended to protect the institution's rather than the individual's freedom. I was told I was being put on notice and that I, and I'm quoting here, quote, had a responsibility to members of the church to do work that will not offend them, unquote. How do you respond to such statements? I was 28. This was my first job out of graduate school. I had just bought my first house. I was trying to support a wife and two small children on a substandard BYU salary. There were all sorts of practical reasons for me to buckle under, and at a particular point in the process, I might well have done so. I was advised by certain faculty members to lay low for a while, save up my work, prove myself a good citizen, and then, once pressure loosened up, slowly start publishing again. Some of the faculty, I realized, had been laying low for a very long time, sometimes several decades. Other faculty advised me to get out as soon as I could. At that point, I stumbled, thanks to Francois Camoin, a writer at University of Utah, onto a one-year position at Oklahoma State University and took it. Once I was there, it quickly turned into a tenure-track position. I was there for 4 years, then taught at University of Denver for 4 years, and now I'm starting my fourth year at Brown University. Some of you already know most of that. In the time remaining, I want to first talk about the process that led up to me leaving the Mormon Church, and then end with a few statements and questions that hopefully will lead to some discussion. While I was still teaching at Brigham Young, I had the idea for the novel that would become Father of Lies. That novel is about the way in which a religion that places too much emphasis on authority unwittingly enables the abuse of children, particularly by religious leaders. It was, I felt at the time, and still feel, not an attack on religion so much as an attack on the misuse of religious of religious authority for evil purposes. Knowing I could never publish this novel while at BYU, I toyed briefly with the idea of publishing it with a pseudonym and then pushed it out of my mind. But in early 1996, after leaving BYU, I began to reread Andrew Vox's crime novels, which deal with child abuse victims with great sensitivity and knowledge, without denying the need to reveal and destroy the darkness in conjunction with healing the abused. I also read Linda Sillitoe's Secrets Keep, which had a big impact on me. And then a friend in Utah forwarded to me an article in The Event called Keeping Mum on Mormon Sexual Abuse. That led me to read the first volume of the case reports of the Mormon Alliance, which contained case studies of child abuse, among other things. All those things made me feel that I should write Father of Lies. So I did, working on it in Oklahoma and then finishing it one summer in my parents' house in Utah. It would be published in 1998 and caused a certain amount of controversy in local priesthood quorums in Oklahoma, but still struggling with the effect that the Battle over Altman's Tongue had had on me. I'd gone semi-inactive, attending some church meetings each week, but rarely all of them. I felt a certain wariness toward the church that it was hard to overcome. In the meantime, I found myself, once I'd left Utah, writing, among other things, stories that had deliberate connections with Mormonism. Altman's Tongue had literally no mention of Mormonism in it at all. There was the novel I'd just discussed, but there was also a group of stories that I collected in a now quite rare chapbook called Prophets and Brothers. And that included, for instance, a story about a couple whose car breaks down and who make the fatal mistake of thinking that three criminals are in fact the three Nephites. A story about a Mormon who decides that he's received revelation that he needs to dig up Ezra Taft Benson's corpse and bring it back to life so as to get the church back on the right track. And a story about a man who decides to give his dog a priesthood blessing using mortar oil despite his wife's and his bishop's objections. As a side note, I realized in looking at old materials when I was getting ready for this talk, that I'd written almost enough Mormon stories for a complete full-length book, many of which I just have always had in a drawer, and that I'd even gone so far as to write a proposal for a book, though I don't remember ever sending it out to anybody. I published some work in Dialogue and other places, and I'm a little puzzled now to realize that I was simultaneously publishing Mormon-themed stories under my own name and under pseudonyms, though I can't think now why I felt I had to do that. I can't really see any reason for why I'd feel that I needed to protect myself for one story and not for another. But one of those pseudonymous stories can be found, if you're interested, in Robert Rawley's anthology, In Our Lovely Deseret. It's called Beyond a Certain Point. Strangely, as I found myself outside of Utah and standing at a certain distance to it, I felt that I could write about it in a way that I hadn't before. There was involved in that a certain degree of longing for Utah, and for, if I'm to be honest with myself now, for Mormonism as well. I felt, now that I had left Utah, very much like a Mormon writer, and wanted to assert that, probably partly because I felt my actual weekly connection with the Mormon Church was starting to fade. I wasn't just writing Mormon stories, but that seemed to be becoming one of my modes, one that I didn't know quite what to think about. And when I had simultaneous offers to publish Father of Lies from a press in Utah that I respect a great deal, and a New York press, I decided to opt for the New York press, partly because the exhaustion of the Altman's Tongue controversy was still fresh in my mind. Around 1997, after Father of Lies had been accepted for publication but before it was published, I stumbled across the fact that one of Brigham Young's grandsons killed a woman around the turn of the century. I was intrigued by early newspaper speculation that the murder was related to the Mormon practice of blood atonement. I filed that information away, but kept coming back to it, and in the end started writing about a young, late 20th century Mormon boy's obsession with the case. That book, which is this book here, is called The Open Curtain. This is a proof copy. It's being published in October with a press that has the very un-Mormon name of Coffee House Press. I was Mormon when I started writing The Open Curtain. By the time I'd finished it, years later, I had left the Mormon Church of my own volition. First by gradually ceasing to participate in the ceremonies of the Mormon Temple, which, to be honest, were the things that I liked most about Mormonism and miss most at this point. Then by tapering back my participation in weekly church services. And finally, finding neither of these to give me sufficient distance by formally requesting to have my records stricken from the church. This was a terrifying thing for me to do, and it was incredibly hard for me to do. Up until the very moment when I got the letter saying that I was no longer a member, I felt certain that I was going to hell, that it was going to destroy me on some personal level and ruin the rest of my earthly life. All the propaganda and scare stories I'd heard since I was very young came back to haunt me for a few months. But once I had the letter, it was at once a tremendous relief. And I was delighted to find that I was still me, and that even if the church had gone into making who I am, and I think it does in a very significant way, I could be who I was and not be a member of the church. Why did I leave the church formally? One reason is that I felt that being a member of the church was limiting my writing in several ways. First of all, I felt that I had found myself too consciously weighing the church's opinion of what I was doing, even after I'd become inactive. And I mean this in two ways, weighing it both in the sense of worrying, self-censoring myself, and very deliberately being tempted to write things that would make people upset in the church. I almost never censored because of what the church thought, but I occasionally did, and I was worried that I would reach the point where I was writing deliberately against the church. I also felt like I needed to be completely outside the church to be able to strike the right balance for The Open Curtain, which deals in some detail with what it was like to grow up in Provo at a certain moment. Second, I felt that being a member of the church was limiting the way in which I processed emotion in my work, and that it would open up my work to move away from this. I think in my most recent stories, stories like Girls in Tents, which I read last time I visited University of Utah, it has. Do I have any regrets about this? I'm very sorry for the complications it caused with my family life, and I regret those, but if I had the choice to take it back, I wouldn't take it back. Was there another alternative for me at the time? Could I have done something else besides leaving the church? I don't know. If there was, I couldn't see it then and still can't see it now, but I'd like to believe that other people might be able to do what they need to do for their writing or art and still maintain the church membership, if that's what they desire. I don't think you can do that and be a typical Mormon, but I do think you can probably do it if you're committed to it. So let me leave you with a few brief things to think about, and then we can open things up for discussion. First is, I believe that being Mormon and an artist is a real opportunity. I believe that it's an opportunity because you can be punished for your work, because your work and your religion can come into collision. That both makes your work feel like it matters in a way that many writers never feel, and it refines you. Second, if you decide to stand up for your own beliefs in the face of your religion, you will lose, but it's worth losing. And that willingness to stand up, even if you know you can't win, does something to you that it's hard to get in any other way. And ultimately, very slowly, very minutely, it provokes the right sorts of change in the structure you're standing up against. Third, if anybody tells you that you have a responsibility to do or not do a particular thing in your work, and you don't feel that yourself, if you do it, you're being a hypocrite. Not only that, if you do it and don't believe it, people will be able to detect the falseness in the work itself. Fifth, because you believe in what you're doing and be willing to suffer for it. If it's not serious enough for you to be willing to lose other things that are important to you, then you probably should stop doing it. And sixth, I personally did not feel that I could serve two masters, and for this reason chose writing over my religion. I'm willing to concede that that might be something specific to the way I think about writing and religion, or that it's the logical extension of the choices I felt I had to make while I was writing Altman's Tongue. But that at the very least, while I was defending Altman's Tongue, excuse me, but at the very least, I think you need to consider this. When you're writing or painting or composing, when you're deeply engaged in the artistic act itself, that has to come first, above everything else. If you're writing with half an eye on other things, it'll compromise the results. What you do, what God you serve at other times, is up to you. But if you can't give yourself to your art at that time, your art will never be as good as it can be. In that sense, I'd argue that for a Mormon writer, writing is always a transgressive act. I think I'll stop there. Okay, so that gives you some sense of where I'm coming from, and I'm more than happy to continue the discussion or answer questions or take rebuttals or anything you'd like to raise.
Brian, I'm just wondering are you pleased when you find Mormons bragging that you're a Mormon and a great writer?
I think the phrase is, some of my best friends are Mormons, isn't that what you said? I do. I mean, one thing that was interesting to me when I was going through this controversy is that there were a lot of Mormons and very active, very faithful Mormons who got what I did and who understood it and who were very supportive of it. And that was, I really appreciated that. I felt that the kind of the authority of the church was not as supportive, but I felt like there was all the potential there for people to understand it, and many people did. And I do. I appreciate people who have been supportive, and many people have been supportive over the years and continue to be in terms of what I do. So, and I appreciate that very much. I mean, I think one thing about the Mormon Church is that it's very textured inside, and there's a lot of ways of believing and a lot of ways of being very faithful and still acknowledging difficult material, and that's one of the reasons I feel like I don't have a beef with the church. I do feel like I disagree with some of certain authorities in the church or people that I've had difficulties with personally, but I really feel like there's the potential there for change, but it's something that's going to occur over a long time.
Do you think this trouble would have not happened at all if you had not been a teacher at BYU?
I think it would have been much less likely to happen if I hadn't been a teacher at BYU. I think that that was what two things put me on the radar in a way that I hadn't been before. One is that I was teaching at BYU. The second was that there was a quite good article on the book that came out in I believe the Deseret News, that was a cover article for the art section, and that suddenly made people aware of the book that might not have been aware of it otherwise. I'd been publishing stories for 5 or 6 years before the book came out, and had never had any difficulty with that, and had published them in some places that were Mormon themed as well. So I do think that was the key thing. That it was very hard for them to, once they realized I was a professor at BYU, they felt like they had to deal with it in a way that they might not have otherwise.
Yeah, I was thinking there's several invisible places in the church, and one of them is older women, so I think we could probably get away with anything.
I hope so.
I was just wondering if you'd share with us who some of your favorite writers were who may have inspired you to do what you do.
Well, When I was very young, when I was 13 or 14, my father gave me a book of Kafka's. He gave me the basic Kafka, and sat down and actually he read a story with me called A Description of a Struggle, which is one of not a very good Kafka story ultimately. And then talked about why he was interested in it and talked about why he was interested in Kafka. And at the time, I'd been reading mainly fantasy and science fiction, and that really did change my perspective. And Kafka is someone who remains very important to me. Other people that have been important, when I was in high school, we read Edward Albee's Zoo Story, excuse me. And in that, in the anthology we read it in, the author's note mentioned that Albee was interested in Samuel Beckett's work, and that got me reading Beckett, and who remains, I think, probably the most important writer to me at this point. But other people include Thomas Bernhardt, has always been an important Austrian writer. Muriel Spark is someone who I've been reading a lot of, who wrote The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. She's an incredibly beautiful stylist and really, really precise in the way she thinks about human nature. I really respect her. There's just a number of people, but that's a few.
I know you're at Brown now. Uh-huh. What are your students doing? You know, what do you foresee in the future? What's really hip right now as far as literature goes with your kids?
I think that in terms of what's going on with contemporary literature, the one of the big directions is towards what gets called new fabulism or new wave fabulism. It's stories that end up seeming like they're in somewhat of an unrealistic or a fantasy space, but at the same time they have a real concern with characters and a real concern with interactions between characters. So people like George Saunders has been, I think, he almost single-handedly has had a dramatic impact on the shape of American fiction. So that's one direction people seem to be moving in. I think that as we seem to be shifting from a more and more towards a visual culture, I see that students are approaching language in a very different way than they were before. And as a result, a lot of the work I'm looking at from students is much more imagistic than it had been, so kind of very impressionistic in some regards. And I think students who 10 or 15 years ago were thinking about film as a way of modeling their stories are now trying to think about what stories could do that films might not be able to do so well. So there's a different sort of approach to that.
Hi. I teach music composition at BYU, and I work with Christian Asplund, who's worked with you and
right.
a friend of yours. We write music that it goes against the grain, but we never get in trouble because, well, unless there's a text involved.
Right, right.
And the same with painters, visual artists, sculptors we know, and so on. I'm just wondering, because so much of what you've described has to do with the word and the text
right.
and language that
it does, and that's the perspective I'm coming from. It's
yeah.
it's one of the difficulties with being a fiction writer is that everybody feels that they can judge
yeah.
a literary work,
yeah.
whereas with the musical work, they may not understand what's going on with it, but they're not as willing to deem it inappropriate or
and the church is founded on a book. I mean,
it
has a special relationship with language. But I wonder what you use the term transgressive in art, and I think that actually what we do is transgressive in art in
mm-hmm.
a lot of ways, but it's not perceived. Well, it's not understood, and therefore
right.
not perceived as transgressive
right.
by those who might do so and might even like to do so
right.
sometimes. And so the subversive power of visual art or
right.
or musical art is quite different. I just wondered if you could comment on that, ruminate on that a little bit.
Okay. The first thing I should say is actually I did an opera with Christian called The Open Curtain, and it's a very different thing than this book here. That's an opera about the life of Joseph Smith. But for some reason I felt like this title was right for this book as well. I do think it's a different thing, and it's partly different because as you're working in either visual arts or in music, you're responding to certain traditions. You're confronting them or transgressing them sometimes, or you're establishing alliances. You're kind of playing out an elaborate field. And I think you do that as a fiction writer as well. And I think that one thing that isn't talked much, at least in Mormon settings, about my work is the way in which I'm responding to the writers that came before me. And there is a kind of elaborate pattern of response and transgression and respect that's all involved in that. But I guess the difficulty is that that can be read into the work, and style can be read into the work. But with music, people tend to read it primarily as style. And if they don't have a vocabulary for dealing with that style, even if the work is transgressive, they don't know quite how to deal with it. So I don't know. I think it's so. In some senses, it's an analogous problem. In other senses, writers are going to always have to confront more directly the religious structure that they're part of than musicians will. But of course, in the history of music, you see lots of moments where music has started riots and such things.
I'd be interested to hear your views as to what the thematic material is that sets the church off. In other words, what are the themes and motifs in sort of descending order in your mind, and according to their evilness? First of all, what are those themes? In that descending order, and uh-huh. And the second part of the question is, why does the church have so much trouble with an honest, fictionalized representation of those themes? Mm-hmm. Why can't they get over it? why can one not be honest in dealing with those themes?
Well, first, I mean, it's been 4 or 5 years since I've been a part of the church, and so I haven't kept up as well as I should in terms of current controversies, and I'm just not as aware as I should be. Having said that, I think you will probably never hear the phrase "the greatest living Mormon pornographer," and that probably is the chief thing. I think that more than anything. If things can be identified as pornographic, the church is very clear about not being for that. And I think that's a term that gets applied very broadly. And that goes back to what I said earlier about when I was growing up, as groups of kids going to see movies, we felt like even though there was a restriction on R-rated movies, it'd be okay for us to see them if they were just violent. But we were really reluctant to see a movie that had nudity in it, and that's very strange. I mean, at the time I thought it was strange. I just I still think it's strange. So I think that's for Mormons one of the chief things, and it probably manifests itself most strongly in film and the way Mormons think about. Film. I can't think of any kind of Mormon filmmakers who have anything close to a nude scene in their work, but I can think of several who have scenes that deal with violence. I think some people do this very well and do it very masterfully. Other people do it without thinking about it, and that's something to consider. So that I think is the chief thing. I think that. The violence that I talk about in Mormon Stone was disturbing to people largely because of the fact that it didn't deal with violence in the way that people expected, that it made people think about it in a different way, and it made them uncomfortable. When I came to BYU doing the interviews for the job, I was very frank with some of my colleagues there, and I said, I'm doing a critique of violence in this book, and I wonder if this is something that I don't see it as a problem, but I want to get your sense of whether it is or not. And they said, as long as there's no sex, it should be okay. So, So I think that for me is the order. I don't know if I can break it down more specifically. I mean, I could try, but I just don't. I don't know quite where I go with that. Like, yeah.
Yeah, Brian, the theme of this session is you can't serve two masters.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, we have many masters.
Uh-huh.
And one, for example, is a commitment to family. And,
of course.
And that apparently was not reconciled in your frame. And yesterday we had sessions on the tension between rationality and faith and
uh-huh.
things of that kind. And I'm just wondering, in all of this play, how you've been able to reconcile, is art here and everything else subservient to that, or how you reconcile all of these really tensions that we right. all have in our lives?
Right. Well, it's hard. I mean, I think that this is, it's very difficult to figure out how to reconcile those things. You know, ultimately, when I felt like I had to make a choice, I chose my art over other things. Having said that, you rarely ever get to the point where you have to make that complete of a choice between things. And you know, I have two children. I'm still very, very much attached to them, despite being divorced, and would do anything for them. So it becomes, you know, I hope that there's never a point where I feel like I have to choose between my children and my art. I don't know what would happen with that. That would be a very strange thing. I don't know how that would work. But when I had to choose between my marriage and my art, I chose my art. But I think it's a very difficult thing. All the time, I think you have these things that are putting demands on you. And there are things that often you can think about as being part of larger commitments or larger part of a larger master, if you want to say that. But not always. And I think even on a daily basis, there's little things where you feel like you have to make these choices, and you make them differently from day to day. So
I'd like to ask kind of an abstract question towards somewhat towards the theme, but I noticed that many creative people you know, lead somewhat eccentric lives. People I can think of right offhand are like Van Gogh, Mozart, Hunter Thompson,
mm-hmm.
people such as that. People that tend to think outside the box and just beyond established, you know, the established norms that we're used to.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just wondering, you know, is there ever going to be a place for that kind of expression when you really want to get it out and still try to remain within within the confines of the community and the church
uh-huh.
and whatever is driving you, mm-hmm. you know?
Hunter S. Thompson would say that place was Mexico. But I think that, I don't know. I don't think in there's going to be a place in the immediate future, just to be honest.
So we're going to have to make a compromise then between what we really want to express and what we feel if we want to stay within certain boundaries and
I think
within
you have
society.
To decide. I mean, I think that one thing that's difficult about being a Mormon artist is that you already have a self-censor that's established inside of yourself. It's the church has to do very little in terms of censoring its artists, partly because we're already censoring the hell out of ourselves. And so that's the difficulty. You have to decide, is this process that's internalized in me something that I believe in? Is it something that the pressure is bringing about still bringing about an artistic experience or a kind of honesty? I mean, I think that as a Mormon artist that you constantly have to think about those things. Whether there'll be a place where you feel like you can be very honest about things still be a member of the church, I suppose it depends on what you feel like you have to be honest about. I mean, it depends a lot on your local leaders. I mean, they can kind of create a space for you, at least a temporary space. Depends how far your work is read or recognized or seen or heard in the larger space, how much attention it draws. I mean, there's always, you can always remain under the radar, I think. But having said that, you really have to realize that it's under the radar. It's not that you're safe, it's that you haven't been identified yet. And if you can live with that, if you can understand that and be willing to accept that as a kind of process, I think that's, you know, it's doable, it's workable.
I'm lucky because I'm a visual artist, so no one ever gets excommunicated for being a visual artist. I guess if I started painting naked women, it might, but as a visual artist, I think an awful lot about, you know, what qualifies as something that's targeted by the church or is a concern to the church, and it seems to me falls under two categories. Mm-hmm. If you are making bad art, the church won't care.
Right.
If you are making good art, that's when they're bothered. And the reason why is I define good art, all good art throughout history asks questions. It asks more questions than it gives answers.
Right.
Bad art pretends to give answers and not ask questions.
Right.
And the irony is the church was founded on asking questions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Joseph Smith went into the grove asking questions.
Yeah.
And he spent his whole life asking questions. What new revelation do you have for me? What more can we learn? What do we need to know? And we've become an institutionalized church, which is more about preserving answers than we are about asking questions.
Right.
And I think the challenge that all artists face is, am I going to be an artist that asks questions, which will inevitably question the status quo, which any institution feels uncomfortable with, or am I going to safely try and give answers that don't challenge
I think you're absolutely right about that, and I do agree with you that that good art asks questions. I do think that there's a continuum, and that one thing that you find with a lot of Mormon writers that I know is that they're willing to ask questions to a certain point, and then they just stop asking, and that's, you know, that's tricky. I mean, and that's what I was talking about earlier, and you can reach a point where your art is never going to be as good as it could be, because you're not willing to go to a certain point. So, thanks. That's a good comment.
Do you feel that the removal of your self-censorship by going away from the Mountain West to back east to Brown, I went there also. I'm an alumni of the writing program. If you're there on Thayer Street, if you're on the green there, and you're working on a piece, do you feel that has changed your writing style or your writing process, actually? Are you writing different pieces now that you're away? Are you writing differently now that you're not here in the valley?
I think every place I've lived, I've written a little differently. I still do have a very active self-censoring mechanism that I have to think about even when I'm writing today. I think that one thing that's happened with my more recent work is that I've become much more interested in family dynamics. And that may have to do with, you know, having left the church. That's something else that's very important to me. And so a lot of my stories end up being, I've been working on a series of stories which are about young girls who have difficult parents and these are young girls trying to figure out what to do with themselves and how to navigate a world that they're not being given help by the parents to understand. And I think there are stories that are they're not violent in the way that the stories in Altman's Tongue are violent. But I find them much more painful, just because it's very hard for me to think of young people, young girls especially, in a position where they should be enjoying life, trying to figure out what to do next with themselves. So that's something that's happened. And you know, there's different, you know, I'm moving in various different directions as time goes on. Another writer who I'm very interested in right now is Orhan Pamuk, Snow. If you don't know that novel, it's set in Turkey, and a lot of what he says about Turkish extremism made me think very closely again about Mormonism and about the culture I grew up in. And so that seems to be pushing me towards a different kind of writing as well.
So. Thank you.
Welcome. Probably one more question, and this should be it.
I think your story is very scary. I remember when I first read Altman's Tongue, my first reaction was, they'll never tolerate this. It's too powerful. As was just said, it's too good. You should have stuck to Harlequin romances, and you would have been applauded.
I'd be a lot richer as well.
But I think another real irony is that supposedly this church believes in a literal Satan, literal evil.
Yeah.
And yet everything has to be sweetness and light. It's such an absurd contradiction. I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Well, I do see that as a contradiction, and I really felt like I was raised in Utah Valley, that I was not exposed to a lot of things going on in the world. At the same time as it was all sweetness and light and people were speaking very positively about what was going on, you know, when I was at Brigham Young, there was a dorm that was kind of busted up because of a prostitution ring that was going on in it. There was, you know, friends of mine who I'd grown up with that I was finding had been abused, and the abuse had been covered up. Other sorts of things like that were there. And so what I began to feel was that, you know, if you claim everything's sweetness and light, it just makes a kind of subconscious to the culture where everything else gets pushed down. And once it gets pushed down too much, it erupts again. And it ends up deforming the culture. So I really felt that what I was doing when I was writing Altman's Tongue was writing a corrective to the culture that I'd grown up in. That I was interested in kind of giving something to stand against that culture, but to do it in a way that I felt was ethical and moral. I think a big part of that book is the people who go through the situations in that book, and they're often very difficult situations, often either don't respond to them or don't respond in ways that we expect. And my notion at the time was that if that's what I'm doing, then it will put the reader in a position where he or she has to respond to what's going on. He or she will have to judge what's going on and try to make sense of it. And I think for many readers that was the case, that it made them think about things seriously and made them wonder about things and made them, ultimately, I think it strengthened their sense of themselves and their sense of the culture. But for some people, they found that very uncomfortable, and it rather than responding to the work, it made them hate the author. And so that's the tricky thing. And I should have known this as well. Swift and Defoe, I did an 18th century literature degree, but both Swift and Defoe had points in their careers where they published things that were difficult for people to read, and people responded to Defoe by putting him in jail. They responded to Swift by becoming very angry with him. So people, you know, if you're doing this thing that makes readers make a decision, ultimately some readers are going to resent it. But hopefully more readers got it and gained from it than resented it. So, yeah.
There is, among writers at least, in this area, people who want to write, who just feel that obsession that some people have with a pen in their hand, that they want to write to the world, like Emily Dickinson, although she didn't ever send her letters out to the world, but she spent her whole life writing. And most of us who write want to be published. And I just like to make this comment that I, as a writer, I found totally, and I find it every day, totally frustrating that the largest seller of books, the largest publisher of books in this area, in all of Mormondom, sets the standard for what will and can be written and published. Mm-hmm. And one instance of this was Richard Paul Evans, who left the country because of neighborhood situations and so on after he became so successful and wealthy, came back with a book that had just a couple of lines in it about a man and a woman who had spent the night sitting on a riverbank. But the woman was married and the man wasn't. And she was talking to the man about her problems, her marital problems and so on, and he was listening. This large publishing company here in Salt Lake, this one that sets the standards for what will be sold and read, refused to carry that book. Mm-hmm. There was nothing going on between these two people.
Uh-huh.
There was no bad language in this book, and he didn't know that it wasn't going to be carried. So he said to his agent, when am I scheduled to do a book signing for this company? And she said, you're not, and not only that, they are not going to carry your book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is something that faces, I mean, someone like you, you found a way to do it by going outside and using outside publishers.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to use inside publishers, you're not going to be able to do it, and you're going to have to, and what I do, I just do the easy thing. Mm-hmm. I do what they say I can, and I don't go outside looking for other book publishers so that I can write differently. I just follow, I'm one of the sheep that follows the line.
Well, it is a difficulty, I think, that there is a kind of approved publisher in Utah, church-approved publisher, and that makes, I think, a really tough time. We were in Salt Lake yesterday, and I hadn't been to Crossroads Plaza and ZCMI Center for a while, and went in to Crossroads Plaza, and of course, you know, it's dominated by the Deseret book there. I thought, well, I'll go over to ZCMI Center, and there's every store is closed except for one at this point. And so you had this kind of thing where at least there was these there was Borders over there. There were other things going on, and for some reason, the Deseret book is very healthy, and everything else seems to have moved for some other reason. So. I think we have to stop. I'm doing a book signing at 1:30, and you're welcome to come talk to me either now or at that, but thank you very much for coming.